We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Morning.
All right, no Maria this morning.
She's out sick. It's that time of year suddenly.
Yeah. Cold and flu season is
exactly
here.
And emphasis on the cold.
Yeah. Why don't they just, you know, cross out autumn and fall and put cold and flu season? All right, let's get rolling, starting with local and a loss here to the local community.
Yeah, kind of stunning news this morning. State Senator Scott White, who was the state senator representing the 46th district, which is northeast Seattle, so View Ridge. Wedgwood, that's the name I was trying to come up with, up in that area, passed away yesterday. Very surprising in that he was only 41 years old.
He was young.
Very, very young. And, you know, while I wasn't his biggest fan, still nobody should die that young, really. Apparent heart attack, but they're not saying right now. Definitely natural causes, but he was found in his hotel room in Kittitas County attending a conference. And just very shocking and sad news, and condolences to his family and his constituents. He will be missed.
All right. Well, from there on to a regular feature we have here on Eat the Airwaves, which is your election endorsements.
The ballots are out. They were mailed on Wednesday, and people should have gotten them in the mail on Thursday and Friday, and they will be. It's an all-mail ballot now, as they all are these days.
As opposed to the pre-suffragette status of things.
So, the ballots are due to be postmarked by Tuesday, November 8th, but the earlier you get them in, the better. So turn them right around. And as it does every election, Eat the State has come out with its endorsements. And we did a print issue this time for the first time in a year to celebrate both the endorsement issue, which is our most read issue of the year, and also the Occupy Seattle and Occupy Wall Street movements. So we have a lot of coverage of that in the print issue, which is out now and available where you find free papers. Or it is available online at www.eatthestate.org. Now, I am in kind of a tricky position here because normally we would have spent a lot of this show going through the endorsements, but because I work for one of the city council candidates, Maria really has to take the lead on that, and she's not here today. So I can talk about the initiatives and the ballot measures.
Very good.
So we'll go through those this week, and then we will go through the elected offices next week when Maria hopefully is back here. And for folks who want to check that ahead of time, either find the print publication or go online to eatthestate.org, and it will be right there.
Yeah, if they want to play along at home while we're doing this.
Exactly. Yeah, score at home. Play bingo where you get credit every time you hear the phrase, "This is a terrible idea." Because you will have five squares in no time at all, trust me. So we do want to talk about the ballot measures, and we'll talk about, start with, initiative measure number 1125, Tim Eymann's latest. This is a terrible idea. And, that's one. And, it's a little early for a drinking game, but you know, you get the idea. This one is Tim Eymann, but it was essentially bankrolled by Kemper Freeman. It's Eymann and Freeman together. At last, you thought this coupling would never happen, or maybe you didn't. But anyway, it would essentially place a number of restrictions on road and bridge tolling. And this is Eymann has latched on in recent years to this whole idea of people have a right to drive, by God, and it's free and it's a God-given right. So he's been upset about red light cameras. He's been waging a bunch of local battles up in Mukilteo around that, and he's taking on tolling now, figuring that this is populist and people hate tolls, so it's a no-brainer, right? So he's trying to give the legislature the right, rather than the non-political commission, the right to set tolls, figuring that the Republicans can this would become a rate increase and therefore it would be impossible to raise tolls. Well, there's a number of problems with this, and there are also some other features of this legislation that we'll get to in a minute, but there are a number of problems with the the legislature doing the tolling procedure. One of them is that no other state in the country does this, that no other state sets tolls through the legislature. And there's a very simple reason for that, but because the companies that buy the bonds that are used to finance the construction of things like the 520 bridge expansion, the new bridge over the Columbia River between Portland and Vancouver, the expansion of I-405 on the east side, the changes that are coming to State Route 99 through downtown, all of those are financed in part through construction bonds, and the bond market wants no part of political bodies setting tolls. So it would be very, very difficult to do any of these things. It also would make it impossible to expand light rail to the east side, even though voters approved that expansion in 2008, because one of the other components of Iman's measure would forbid the use of highway right-of-way for non-highway uses, and in order to get it across I-90, you would need to put the bridge across, you need to put the train across that same bridge. So it would block rapid transit, which is one of the major reasons why Freeman is opposing it, because he wants everybody to drive to Bellevue rather than, God forbid, ride a train, because that might enable some of the riffraff to come from Seattle. And it would make it very, very difficult to continue to even repair, let alone expand any of our existing road infrastructure. So, yeah, as I say, this is a terrible idea. Go ahead and have another shot there, and we'll vote no on that one. The next one, initiative measure 1163, and this is very similar to I-1029, which was passed by voters in 2008, mandating training and certification requirement for home health care workers. The problem with that is that the legislature basically ignored it. They set it aside during the budget crisis last year after the two-year waiting period where the legislature can't do anything about past initiatives. And if the past is any guide here, even if this is passed, the legislature is likely to ignore it again, because there's simply no money. The state is going to have to make huge cuts next year, and including cutting some really already cut to the bone social services that are desperately needed, much more than certification of home health care workers are. So as reluctant as I am to say this, because it is certainly a worthy goal, but it's also a hard choice that has to be made, and there's a limited pool of money at this point. $80 million would be the cost over the next couple of years to enact this proposal, and it's money that the state simply doesn't have. So we're recommending a no vote on that one, even though, you know, hopefully when the state does have more money, it'll come back again. Although technically, actually, I believe it's still on the books from 2008. Initiative measure 1183. This is a terrible idea. This is the one we were talking about a few minutes ago. Mike's getting kind of drunk over there.
Taking a shot every time he says it's a terrible idea.
An attempt by Costco, Costco in particular. We talked about $13.4 million that they've poured into this campaign in order to get big box stores and only big box stores the right to sell hard liquor. It would privatize hard liquor sales, dismantle the existing state store structure, and instead transfer it to stores like Costco and Walmart and Fred Meyer and so forth. And it's, you know, it's frankly, it's a terrible idea on several levels. It would be an end to union living wage jobs that are the unionized jobs in the state liquor store system. It would take away the most likely distribution route if the 2012 initiative that the ACLU is backing that would decriminalize or legalize marijuana is passed. That would be the simplest way to distribute it, so that you'd still have a check on age and keep it out of the hand of teenagers, is to distribute it to the state liquor store system. Well, you can't do that if it's dismantled this year by Costco. It would probably not result in any cost savings, frankly, to consumers, because there's no history at all of privatization resulting in cost savings to consumers. That's usually the promise, and usually exactly the opposite happens. And last but not least, you know, we really don't need more hard liquor on the streets in Seattle or the state of Washington. You can debate that, but I don't think it's a particularly good idea. So We want to vote no. Oh, and by the way, it would also cost the state a ton of money at a time when, again, money is very scarce. And it would translate directly into lost health care for people, lost environmental protections, you know, all the other things that the state is going to have to cut if it loses revenue sources like this. So a very strong no on 1183. And then last but not least, on both 1125 and 1183, these are initiatives that have been bankrolled by a very self-interested particular corporate interest. Kemper Freeman is a developer for 1125 and Costco for 1183. And, you know, when the initiative process was envisioned back in the day by Washington voters, it was so ordinary citizens could have a say on issues that the state legislature wasn't willing to move forward. It wasn't so that huge corporations can bypass the legislative process when they can't buy enough legislators in order to get their measures passed. So just on that principle alone, I think no votes on those are very advised, because if those fail, it makes it a little bit less likely that other corporations will pour tens of millions of dollars into initiative measures in the future. And then there's a couple of state Senate joint resolutions also, 8205 and 828026. Those two measures are basically housekeeping amendments to the Washington State Constitution. The first concerning the length of time a voter must reside in the state of Washington in order to vote for the U.S. President and Vice President. The second concerning the stabilization of the state's rainy day fund. And those are both yeses. Finally, we have a couple of propositions in the city. Proposition number one is the Families and Education Levy, and there are some concerns with this one because it's a doubling of the past Families and Education Levy at a time when, again, you know, people's pocketbooks are thin, but, you know, that's no reason to vote no against it. And the other reason that you would offer to vote no against this is, all of the various things that you probably heard a lot about in the 7:30 interview that are wrong with the school district itself. But that's an argument to change people on the school board, which we'll talk about next week. It's not an argument to deny the school district itself funding. So we're urging a yes vote on Proposition 1. At the same time, school board members, hopefully new school board members, will enact some strong benchmarks and metrics so that the additional money that's being spent on programs, a number of which are good ideas, actually are tied to results, and those have good outcomes for students, which, you know, is supposedly the whole idea. Finally, the Seattle Transportation Benefit District Proposition Number 1. This is one where the ETHA State recommendation, which Jeff Stevens wrote, because I had to recuse myself this year, and my personal recommendation diverged, so I'll give you both. Jeff urges yes on this one. This is the $60 car tab fee, the vehicle license fee, that's being enacted in order for, I believe, I don't have it in front of me, but I believe the percentages are 49% to public transit, 29% to 22% for sidewalks and pedestrians and bicycles, and 29% for road repair and infrastructure. Jeff is urging a yes vote on this one. He had a typo on this. It's in addition to the $20 car tab fee that was approved by the King County Council this past August, and in addition to the $20 car tab fee that was already approved by the City of Seattle over this past year. It would fund all the things that I mentioned in there, would make Jeff's rationale for this is that it would help make Seattle less car dependent because of the money that it puts into public transit, bicycles, pedestrians, and so forth. The problem that I have with it, I actually have several. One is that it's very regressive. It's a very regressive form of taxation in that the same amount of money that you pay for a $500 beater or a $50,000 luxury car, it's still the same $60. And again, it's at a time when a lot of people are hurting economically and it's already expensive to drive, and we don't have many good public transit choices. The other major problem that I have with it is where the money is actually going, because public transit in this case is a euphemism for the streetcar lines for South Lake Union and the Internet and First Hill, and connecting the streetcar lines on the South Lake Union and First Hill. It doesn't create new bus routes. It doesn't create new light rail. What it does is help Paul Allen's vanity project on South Lake Union and connect it to the First Hill station, because they did didn't build a light rail station on First Hill. So it's sort of a makeup to that neighborhood. So it wouldn't help with public transit for most of the city. It would actually, it wouldn't generate new public transit riders. It would simply take away from existing bus lines. And a lot of the other money should be better spent. The city has over $1.5 billion worth of backlog infrastructure repair projects that there's no funding for road repairs, potholes, and bridge repairs. There's no money in this at all for bridge repairs. The money that, and this is over for the next 10 years, the money for road repairs and potholes is only 1/10 of what it would be required to address the existing backlog, let alone what's going to happen over the next 10 years. And it's not a very good allocation of money. And so what I would prefer to see is the city council come back with a better proposal, a proposal that is less regressive, a proposal that allocates the money better. You know, it's not as though some of these, the public transit and other things don't need to happen. This is just not a very good plan. So my recommendation is no on that. Jeff says yes, look it up, and our caveat for all of the initiatives and all of the elected offices also is, as usual, free to state. You know, do your research, make up your own mind, use us as maybe a guide, but only one of many guides, hopefully.
Very good. All right, moving on. You touched on Costco. Did you want to expand on that further?
Well, just that they set their own record by giving another $2.5 million this past week. This is like our weekly update at this point, because they keep pouring more and more money into this initiative. The total now $13.4 million for I-1183. So they're very definitely trying to buy their very own state law, and it tells you how lucrative they think this is and how much money they plan to make on it, and probably how much more they plan to charge if this passes by the fact that they're willing to spend this much money, and they think it'll be a bargain if this passes. So let the buyer beware, as they say.
All right. Also, news out this week about city council plans for 2012.
Yeah, an interesting tidbit in Publicola, the local political wonk website, last evening, that Seattle City Council is already looking at who will get the presidency and the committee assignments for 2012. Now, this is somewhat problematic in that voters have actually not voted on who will be on Seattle City Council in 2012 yet. That is why we have the ballots in our hands that we were just talking about. But that's not stopping Seattle City Council Arrogance in Action from talking about plans for next year. So they're looking at Sally Clark, who is up for re-election this year as the president in 2012, and they go through and they talk about all the different people who will have heads of different committees, Bruce Harrell as public safety, the guy who wants to be mayor. Oh, Tim Burgess as the head of the budget committee, which is a very influential position. So positioning him for a run for mayor in 2013. They also were talking about Bobby Forish as getting the short straw and getting the Seattle Public Utilities chair, which is generally considered the least glamorous the least glamorous of the committee assignments. So they're already, it seems like, throwing Jean Godden under the bus because she's running against Forsch for re-election. And it would seem that voters still have to make up their mind on that. Yeah. So kind of, again, arrogance in action. This is what the masters of your universe are thinking and planning, and not particularly waiting for you to weigh in before they decide.
All right. Moving on to National and California and the Bank of America.
Yeah, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, where the Attorney General for the state of California, the largest state and one of the states hardest hit by the mortgage crisis, had walked away from the national negotiations led by the Obama administration with top banks on damages for the mortgage crisis. The banks, of course, wanting indemnity against any other legal claims in exchange for signing off on that. California refusing to do that. This week, they subpoenaed Bank of America as part of their investigation into whether the bank and presumably other banks misleadingly sold high-risk mortgage-backed securities to the state pension plan, thereby defrauding a lot of pensioners out of their, you know, retirement money. So this is something that Washington State's Attorney General, if he weren't Rob McKenna, could also be doing. But he's busy running for governor and cozying up to the banks instead. So we're not seeing that here. But it's very good to see the state of California do that. And hopefully New York and some other influential states will take the lead as well.
All right. And moving on, a change in the corporate media narrative?
Yeah, an interesting study from Think Progress out this week that the media has dropped its obsession with debt and is now focusing on the actual jobs crisis. It was they did a survey in July of Fox, CNN, and MSNBC News, and found far more mentions of the national debt of the unemployment crisis, literally thousands and thousands of mentions, obsessed with the deficit in the national debt and you know, needing to have budget cutbacks and yada yada yada. And that, of course, was part of the whole debt ceiling crisis that the Republicans initiated also. Well, Occupy Wall Street has changed that narrative, and the Obama administration, and it's a continuation of a push of a jobs plan, even though it's kind of DOA in the Congress, has also helped with that. Those numbers now have reversed, and the media is actually talking a lot more about unemployment and about ordinary people having a hard time making ends meet. So for people who say the Occupy Wall Street protests aren't having any significant impact and don't have any goals, they've already had an impact. They've brought this into the national consciousness in a way that it very obviously wasn't 2 or 3 months ago, even though the crisis was with us then too.
All right. Moving on to international, starting with Iraq.
Yeah, the Obama administration announcing yesterday with great trumpeting and fanfare on a Friday news dump that we will withdraw the last of our troops from Iraq at the end of the year. Now, we've talked about this in past weeks. That was the agreement all along. President Bush, before he left office in 2008, signed a status of forces agreement with Iraq that specified the end of 2011 as the deadline for the U.S. to have its military leave Iraq. The Obama administration has spent the last couple of years, both Pentagon leaders and leaders within the civilian defense sector and Secretary of State and so forth, have spent the last couple of years in negotiation with Iraq to try and extend that. And in fact, if you've been reading corporate media over the past few months, the assumption all along has been that Obama would find a way around the SOFA agreement and have additional troops staying on in Iraq. So Obama's kind of trying to have it both ways here. He worked very hard to try and extend that deal. Then when the United States, as it generally does on foreign bases, was insisting on immunity from prosecution for U.S. soldiers if they commit any crimes on Iraqi soil, which has also been an issue in Okinawa and a number of other places where U.S. soldiers have misbehaved. But it's hugely politically toxic in Iraq because of Blackwater and because of a number of massacres and misdeeds by U.S. soldiers that have essentially gone unpunished. Certainly have gone unpunished in terms of any action allowed by the Iraqi justice system. So that was a non-starter for Iraqi politicians. And so whether you believe this was a poison pill that was put in by Obama, and he knew all along they would reject it, and so this was his clever way of getting around. And this is kind of like, you know, too many dimensional chess here. Whose wink and nod you believe, whether you think this was the actual desired outcome by Obama or whether this was sort of a clever pivot of his to accept credit for something which is politically popular but wasn't what he actually wanted to do. So we'll see. Now, it was interesting that Defense Secretary Leon Panetta yesterday was talking about, well, we're still going to be talking with the Iraqis about military advisors and joint training exercises and arms deals and so forth. We'll just be doing it as one sovereign nation to another now. So, yeah, wink, wink, nod, nod. So, you know, whether that's more of the same, whether that's the same sort of joint military exercises and whatnot that the U.S. does with scores of other countries, or whether it's both, we'll leave that up to you to decide.
All right. Moving on, Libya.
Yeah, the king, the tyrant is dead, Muammar Gaddafi, dying this week in Libya, and Senator Lindsey Graham wasting no time saying, well, there's money to be made here. So it's going to be very, very interesting, as it has been with Egypt, to see where the Libyan revolution goes from here now that it is definitively over. In Egypt, of course, a number of questions are emerging emerging over the emergency laws that the ruling military council has subsequently put in place, and whether they want to see any kind of a meaningful transition to democracy at all in Egypt. A lot of democracy reformers there are really upset with the ruling military folks at this point. So it'll be very interesting to see where that goes. In Libya, the issue is all about the different tribes that are dominant in Libyan politics and whether they can make common cause with each other above and beyond the overthrow of Gaddafi, or whether things are going to splinter and continue to become very difficult there. And then, of course, you've got all sorts of American and European corporations and interests that are circling in like vultures on the oil supply there, and that's going to complicate things too. So that's worth continuing to keep an eye on even after the passing of Gaddafi.
All right. Greece.
A general strike going on in Greece around austerity measures there that Parliament passed in order to get a bailout from the European Union this week. And a very effective national strike camped out in front of the Parliament building and essentially bringing the national economy to a halt. And it does raise the question of what the next logical moves are for the Occupy Wall Street movement. And if you don't see any kind of a meaningful political transition into accountability for the criminals who have ruined our economy here and making sure that they can't do it again, because a lot of that same behavior, as we talk about a lot on this show, that was going on in 2006, 2007, 2008 is still going on today, some of it even worse than ever. So if there's not accountability for that, and if there's not regulations that are put in place to prevent that from continuing, then we start needing to be talking about a general strike in this country as well, because it works.
All right. And finally, Japan.
Yeah, the Prime Minister of Japan announcing this week that Japan is now going to spend $13 billion on radiation cleanup. This is the same Japanese government that's been insisting all along that there isn't any significant radiation contamination outside the immediate area around the damaged reactors at Fukushima. We talked a couple of weeks ago how they were citizens groups were finding contaminated soil in metropolitan Tokyo, an area of 35 million people, and the contamination being a lot more extensive than the Japanese government was willing to recognize. If it costs that much money to clean up just the areas that the Japanese government is recognizing, it raises the question of what is the actual cost, and what were the people saying about cost-effective nuclear energy once again?
Too cheap to meter.
Yeah, yep.
All right, events.
Well, we've got several of them. Today at noon, downpour or no downpour, there will be a rally for the Occupy Seattle folks down at Westlake to build the movement of the 99%. The day of 1,000 umbrellas, or maybe 5,000 umbrellas or 10,000 umbrellas. Hopefully nobody will get arrested for wielding an umbrella as a permanent structure. Monday is United Nations Day, and there will be another number of events going on around town to commemorate that. Wednesday at 5:30, the City Council will be holding a Budget Committee special public hearing on the 2012 budget that's been proposed by the mayor, and there are a number of important aspects to that, so people should go down to City Council chambers at City Hall and check that out. And then also on Wednesday at 7 p.m., there's an event around folks who want to create a state bank that would be established in order to be an alternative to the predatory banks that the folks at Occupy Seattle are protesting. That will be with Ellen Brown and State Legislator Bob Hasegawa. $5 on the UW campus at Kane Room 120. So go check that out, 7 o'clock on Wednesday night.
All right. Talking as we do every week with John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
You can find Eat the State, and I've been waiting a year to say this, wherever you find free publications around town. Although actually, because we haven't done it in a year, our distribution network has, shall we say, atrophied a little bit. So if you're willing to help us distribute those free publications, drop us a line at info@eatthestate.org, and we will be happy to hook you up with some papers and a part of town. Some parts of town we have pretty well covered, and some parts not quite so much. So look for it around town, and if you want to help distribute it, drop us a line. The endorsements are in the issue, as we talked about, and as we'll be talking about again next week on this show. And then also we have a bunch of material on Occupy Seattle and Occupy Wall Street, and other good stuff as well. So check it out, www.eatthestate.org, online also for all those endorsements and whatnot, or where you find free publications.
All right.
Oh, and it's a really bad idea, just for people who aren't drunk enough yet.